session number 6245, Reel 5.
Mr. Richards, Reel 5. We were talking about funerals in the camp and the use of a cemetery in town.
Yes, the Japanese even had a memorial service, probably at the beginning of 1943, in the Anglican cemetery in the town, and actually put up a monument to those who had died in the, up to that point. When it was a Roman Catholic funeral, the fathers were joined by the Austrian and German fathers, who had not, of course, been interned, but were under house arrest in their own missions. And these good fathers used to process along the road to the cemetery, singing from their devotional books in Latin and in plain song. The Japanese couldn't understand Latin. It was, in fact, a Latin resume of the news. But afterwards, of course, when the other ranks began to die so much, and that they were being carried up in the end by the beginning of 45, they were beginning to be carted up the road, half a dozen a day. And a part of the land inside the perimeter was used. And it got so bad that they used to use bottomless coffins so that you could undo the trap and let the body out and bring the coffin back for future use. And associated with that was a gang of soldiers we used to call the Stengamati, the half-dead lot. In fact, I think they called themselves that. They could barely lean on their hoes when they were out supposed to be digging. And their one interest in life was what happened to the blanket of the chap in the third bed down who died last night. Somebody reports that so-and-so has died. Oh, who got his blanket? At once. Because being so underfed, and although the climate was nice and warm, we used to get very cold. And people were getting up at night, no fat around the kidneys, you see, so you were, often had to get up, and you didn't sleep an awful lot, in fact, because you were underfed and you had no fat on you anywhere, so you felt the cold miserably, apart from pangs of hunger, of course. Which we...
You've talked both of being underfed and, of course, being deficiently fed, so to speak. Can we pull those ideas together with a list of, let's say, fairly typical drink and food that you would have in a given day or week?
Well, all I can remember with any certainty is the about the food intake we had is when it was at its worst. We started off with a reasonable ration of rice and salt fish and a certain amount of pork or pork fat. But the rations gradually diminished over the first 2 years in that camp. And at the end, we were getting about a tablespoonful, or if we were lucky, two, of boiled rice a day. And boiled potato tops, which were chopped up coarse and dark green. A teaspoonful of salt fish. And if we were lucky, a ration of pork for the week, which might consist of one pig's head with the tongue removed, or a bucket full of pig's blood, or something like that. And this is for 200 odd men. We made up with produce from the gardens.
How did did you go about organising this, and what extent of land did you have under your control?
I don't know what acreage it would be, but it was a large patch of, I suppose, 2 or 3 acres within the perimeter fence, which was cleared of rubber trees, and the trees made fuel for cooking, and then planted with sweet potatoes, tapioca, sugarcane, and several other crops that were liable to be well yielding. They were manured with all the night soil which was taken out in 40-gallon drums, 4 men to 1 drum.
Was this a job which was rotated, or did much the same people do it every time?
Well, the people did it for a longish spell. The gardeners were the people everything revolved around, I suppose. They were Danny Lattles and Snellis and Griffin and Digby himself, of course, were the leading lights of the gardeners, with one or two from North Borneo. And they kept it going, and they were raising a ton a week, a quarter of which went to the women's camp.
What implements did they use?
Hoe? That was all we had. Oh, axes. Definitely. We had one or two axes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yes. Well, they had to have axes for cutting the trees down. Mm.
But they were strictly supervised, I imagine, by the Japanese.
Oh, yes, there's sentries watching over everybody in them. Mm. Which is surprising what you can hide amongst. Tapioca grows 7 foot tall, you know.
Did you do either of these two jobs yourself?
I did the I was gardening for a while, and I got so handy with one of these hoes, chunkles, that on occasion I got myself a stray chicken. I simply bided my time and simply had its head off just like that, with one accurate swipe. The inside the camp, inside our own section of the camp, of course, we grew a lot of other things that didn't lend themselves to field cropping. I was a lot of the time working in the kitchens. So I ran a small patch, maybe 20 feet wide, 20 feet square, inside the wire. So did many other people. But to grow a little sugarcane, a few peanuts, mucus beans, lady's fingers, heavy cropping, a green vegetable which is full of iron, I only know the Malay name of it, chunkup manis. And chilies, and ginger, and turmeric, and things of that sort, things that could be reckoned as spices, to make an otherwise dull diet more acceptable.
Were there periods in the year when this food was not available, or much less of it was available?
No. No, because there are virtually no seasons in that climate. You can grow sweet potatoes and tapioca, you can just go on and on and on and on all year round.
Did the Japanese provide any of the roots or seeds?
I don't know where the original stock came from, but we multiplied it for ourselves. Papayas, for instance, pawpaws. You get one good and ripe before the civet cat gets it. And take out the seeds, which you can also roast to make an ersatz curry. And you wash the seeds and dry them, put them in the ground, and in a week or two you've got inch-high seedling. And in approximately 11 months you're taking the first fruit.
What kind of facilities did you have in the kitchen upon which to cook whatever was necessary?
Kitchens were the Punjabi camp kitchen. Three of these very large pans called woks nowadays. Well, these things were about 3 feet, or a good 3 feet across, iron, set in concrete with the fire underneath.
Where did the fuel come from?
Rubber trees.
Which you chopped down yourself, or
yes.
Was it provided?
Yes, yes. The real hard work was chopping up the taproot. Limited amount of salt. The kitchens had a tin roof, so that in the heat, in the middle day, it got extremely hot inside. I have nearly passed out in with that and lack of salt. And I found that you could eat a teaspoonful of salt, if you could get it, without making yourself sick. And you immediately recovered in a matter of minutes.
What was the supply of water like to you?
There was a piped supply that had been laid onto the military camp, of course. So we simply used that.
That included drinking water, of course.
But it was drinking water, yes. It was part of the town supply.
It's just that earlier you referred to some of the other ranks having problems getting used to lack of water.
Oh, no, I meant lack of water for washing.
Ah.
Getting used... They didn't have a lack of water, but they didn't... They had no means of knowing that the local people are in and out of the bath half a dozen times a day. They feel the least bit dusty, prickly, hot, so forth, into the river, out again, and there's no need to dry yourself. But they didn't know that. Why should they?
Was there any substitute used for soap?
The rats stole what soap there was, if they could. And we ate some of them too. We had a limited amount of soap. Well, I suppose the Japanese gave us a ration of soap.
You don't remember for sure?
No, I don't remember for sure. I think they must have done, because we wouldn't have brought in enough soap to last for 3 years now. They must have done.
And you're not aware of being without soap?
No, but we didn't use very much of it, because, again, if you've got plenty of water, you don't need a lot of soap.
Did most men not bother shaving? That's my impression.
No, we didn't, no. We had razors. I mean, I had one or two blades, of course, that I'd come in with, but they obviously weren't going to last, because the foreseeable future was a long way off. So we kept them and grew beards. I think there were one or two who managed to shave all the time, but most of them grew beards. There was a great competition in beard growing, too.
But finally, Mr. Richards, I wonder if we could turn to considering relationships and discipline with the Japanese. First of all, I imagine you had to learn a certain amount of language in order to understand Japanese commands. Can you give some examples of the sort of commands that you would have to be quick to obey and thus to understand?
Yes, the obvious ones are Kyotsuke, for to stand to attention. Kere, bow. Yasumi, which is to stand at ease or take a rest, take a break. And the numbers from one to however many was necessary, depending how many were standing in the row, at roll call. But at the time, I probably understood a few other words, but not to speak Japanese. I never made a study of it.
Did you find it easy to pick up these terms?
No, there was no difficulty over it at all. Because we had already learned local languages, and we were familiar with, if not speaking Chinese, at least hearing it spoken. So that it didn't offer any difficulty to us. Some of the other ranks, of course, got it wrong sometimes. But the Japanese method of committing suicide, harakiri, They always used to call it Harry Curry. I mean, but then they weren't Japanese speakers.
Were there expectations of a response on your behalf to different levels of the Japanese hierarchy in the camp?
No, I think we simply had to treat all Japanese. You would bow a little more deeply if you recognised a high-ranking officer, obviously.
And would you bow as a matter of habit or routine?
In the camp, it was a matter of habit. Much better for you, because you'd get cuffed across the ears, at least, if you failed.
Did you see this happen?
Oh, yes. I mean, somebody who was thinking about something else. Maybe was talking to somebody, and Japanese sentry, with whom he had nothing to do, would shout out this come to attention business, and he didn't hear him. There'd be another shout. He'd be summoned across. The Japanese sentry didn't go to him. He's the Japanese sentry in order to take a beating. Oh, yes, that happened. But you got to the stage where you didn't take awful notice of little ones like that. It was the big beatings that you didn't actually see, witness, that could be.
And for what reason would these beatings be administered? What sort of transgression?
Or somebody was caught, as they thought, getting through the wire, or being where he shouldn't be, the Japanese suspecting that he was in contact with the outside world or something like that, and they'd take him in for a beating.
And was this beating, shall we say, haphazard, depending on the mood of the officer of the moment on duty?
It could be, but some of it was more than that. One I remember in particular was Salua, this interpreter fellow. He was suspected of being in contact with people outside, as it was anybody's guess, he obviously was. He was taken away to the guard room and sorely beaten, and he was kept, and he was one of them, he was kept on bread and water, rice and water diet, for about a week. But then one night there was a tremendous flap in the Japanese guard room. He'd taken a bottle to go to the loo. Well, that was normal. You had a bottle of water because there was no paper. But he didn't come back. When they went to look for him, he'd broken the bottle and cut his wrists. Japanese were in a tremendous flat about that.
Did he live?
No. Well, certainly he didn't. He did when they found him, I think. He made sure of that. We knew what it was all about. He'd always said, I mean, he was a Chinese student, you see, he knew all about this sort of thing. He had always said that if he was in a fearful hole and he could see no way out of it, he would take the view of his own life that the Chinese would have taken and leave it. Mm-hmm. And he was simply afraid that he wouldn't stand up to the torture that would be applied in his case, and that he would give away his friend. So he denied that information to the Japanese altogether by simply cutting his own wrists.
Did the camp get to hear about major beatings which didn't end in death, as this particular incident had?
Oh yes, you always knew if one of your number was taken away and beaten up. But what happened in other sections of the camp, of course, we wouldn't know. And there were a lot of things that one didn't inquire about. Mm-hmm. You left it, that was one of the points of having a committee. They were prepared to find things out and act accordingly and take the can if need be, poor chaps. But the ordinary internee found that it was that he could play safe by not making inquiries, not poking his nose in. The less he knew, the less he could tell.
Mm. Were you ever asked to give information by the Japanese?
No. Mm. Nor were many of us. Imagine the Japanese assumed that we didn't know anything. Mm. which was the perfectly true. I mean, what we did know was garbled.
Did you form any positive relationships with Japanese? People have, for instance, talked about swapping photographs with families and so on. That sort of level of exchange, was this very common?
Probably. I think I have seen one or two instances of that, but quite casual in the in our section of the camp. I dare say it happened a lot more with some of the soldiers. But it was casual. I mean, I wouldn't have said it formed any kind of friendship. Mm. Some of the soldiers, of course, formed friendships with the Japanese and used to go off trading with them because the army, the navy of the army, was followed as in the shape of guards by these Formosan youngsters who were for the most part pretty brutal. And they had been trained for this kind of work and nothing else. And some of them were thoroughly detested by us. There was one sergeant major with very thick spectacles. We always called him Four Eyes. But I've forgotten now what their names were or anything about them. Some were helpful. And this chap, Salu, you see, could get a lot closer than we could because he spoke Japanese. And he also spoke Hokkien, but the Taiwanese could speak, which was their own language. So he was speaking their home tongue to them. So he could get a lot more out of them. But I wouldn't have said that there were any friendships. They were too efficient, I suppose, the Japanese. They were running a camp. They were setting the rules they thought appropriate. And we grumbled like we always do, but from the Japanese point of view, I think most of it was pretty reasonable.
And indeed, from your own point of view, you don't feel there was anything that was, although obviously that did impinge upon your life, unreasonable in terms of being an internee?
No, we were... perhaps an indication of that is that, apart from small incidents and niggles, things that bore very heavily at the time, no doubt, if I could remember them, when we were finally released, I don't think any of us took this revengeful view that some of the journalists about the place were taking at the time. I don't think the Australian troops were all that harsh with the Japanese either. If they wanted to cut their own throats and commit suicide, well, they let them, but...
do you know of any instances of that?
Well, it was always our camp commandant, poor chap, whose own home was blown up in Hiroshima. He told us about it, and then he attended the formal parade at the release of the camp. Had his sword was removed, I think, by a strapping Australian. He said, you know, come on, cover, you won't need that anymore. But as Digby said, it was very brave of him actually to turn up. He was the camp commandant, after all. Fair enough. He afterwards committed suicide. He's said to have cut his throat in the space of about 20 minutes with a blunt table knife. And I was always given to understand that the troops knew what was going on and did nothing to stop him. But on the other hand, they didn't do anything to make him do it. It was his own decision.
Turning now then to the details of your own release, I think there was a certain improvement in conditions prior to release. For instance, your contact with home and also food supplies later on. Could you enlarge upon this?
Yes. We had no letters from home until the last few months of 1944. Then we received one or two batches of letters written a month, each month, between September and May 1944. We got those, the last of that lot, in December. And then three more letters, which had been written in October and November 1944, I got in the Australian hospital at Le Bourne in September
45. And parcels?
Parcels, only one or perhaps two parcels between six of us, I think.
This was a Red Cross
once,
parcel.
Mm. Once, only one lot.
You had had, of course, no contact with any outside agency.
No,
the time.
I see from letters written to my people by the government agent that news was very hard to come by because the Japanese would not allow any Red Cross representatives or anybody else into the area. So we never saw anybody.
And the immediate circumstances of your release were?
Well, in August 1945, after Hiroshima, the Australians began giving us airdrops and food and clothing, all very welcome. One poor fellow from North Borneo was killed by a bundle of clothing, having lasted so long. We were finally released the day after the surrender of the Japanese on the 11th of September. And at that time there were 2,500 left in the whole camp of all communities, but only half of them could walk with any ease. I was one of those who could walk, but I had a magnificent sore on one heel.
Would you say that your own section had been better treated than a number of others?
No, I don't think we'd been better treated. We'd been better looked after. We'd been more accustomed to the climate, the diet, and understanding of the Japanese, perhaps, so that we could cope.